Good morning. The Senate Education Committee meeting is called to order. Regrets for the late start today. The time is 9:42 a.m. on Monday, May 10th, 2021. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Stevens, Senator Hughes, Senator Begich, and myself, Chair Senator Holland. Senator Machicki is on other state business today. Thank you to Jeannie, our recording secretary, and Alex, our moderator today. And thanks for the patience of Mr. Forney, who's been standing by waiting to do his presentation today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. We have no official business on today's calendar, but we do have a quorum. Today we will hear a presentation from the Pension Trust Advisors regarding the teacher retirement system. This presentation is a work product of a contract with Legislative Budget and Audit, which resulted in the delivery of this report on January 18, 2021. I requested this presentation in Senate Education as the topic is pertinent to the teacher recruitment and retention working group recommendations, which we heard last week. Our speaker is Mr. Flick Fornia. Mr. Fornia, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation. We have it up on the screen here, and when you get to the end of a slide, if you just say next slide, then it'll give me an opportunity to identify any questions the committee may have. But if you hear no questions offered, then we'll just go on to the slide after that, okay?
Thank you, Chairman Holland. Yeah, my name is William Fornia. I'm an actuary, a credentialed actuary. I'm from Denver, Colorado. I've done work off and on for various entities in Alaska since 2004. I was hired by the Arm Board as their first reviewing actuary when I was with another firm, Gaber, Roeder & Smith. Then I was hired again by the Arm Board in 2008 to do an actuarial audit of the both PERS and TRS. And I was actually up in Juneau for that. And I've been to Juneau a couple times since then. I started my own firm in 2010, and one of my early clients in 2011 was the Alaska Public Pension Coalition. So I've been working for labor organizations off and on since 2011 in Alaska. I also am working for the Firefighters Association on House Bill 55, which is a legislation putting in a new pension for the police and firefighters, somewhat similar to what I'm going to be discussing today. If you want to go to the next slide, that would be great. Thank you. So basically, I'm going to give you some background on the pension issues, the current costs of the pension program, a potential viable plan design change for both PERS, other PERS and TRS. I'm going to focus just on the teachers today, unless you have questions on the other group. And then proposed is too strong, but what's being studied here is potential variable plan designs. In a nutshell, the tiers you had before 2005 were a pure defined benefit plan. And if things don't go as well as the actuary projects they're going to go, the costs will increase and all fall on the shoulders of the employer, the state, basically. What was put in its place for people hired after 2005, for all three groups, public safety, teachers, and PERS, other PERS, was a defined contribution plan. So I will probably slip into lingo and say DB or DC quite often. I apologize in advance if that's going to require quick thinking. And a DC plan is essentially like a 401k, where a contribution is made into a pension fund, and when one retires, and it's invested, and in your case, as in most 401ks, the employee has a choice of how they want to invest it. There's lots of terrific investment options. They're selected by the Arm Board. They're vetted. They're good. Best practices, I would say. But they're still their choice. And as the vagaries of the market are what they are, they may or may not be adequate for the retirement. And that structure is very unusual in the public sector. Most of the other lower 48 and Hawaii have defined benefit plans for their members. But as you know, you don't. And so what this is kind of an exploration of if we went back to some kind of in-between type plan, how might it work? And this is what I'm calling a variable plan, because the idea is instead of so in the two extremes, the defined benefit, you know, old tier extremes, basically every, as you all painfully know, all of the risk has fallen on the employers. On the other hand, on the defined contribution approach, all the risk falls on the employees or the members. And in particular, the risk that is really difficult for them is the how long am I going to live risk. Like I'm 62. I have worked for companies with defined benefit plans, but most of my retirement is coming from my own savings. And if I live to 92, I need a lot more money saved up or pay myself a lot less than if I live to 72 and went once I retire. So the problem is each individual doesn't have a good idea of how long they're going to live. And so there's this built-in inefficiency of that approach. And maybe some of you are saving for retirement primarily instead of having a defined benefit plan, but that's the dilemma you're facing. So you don't know how long your money is going to last because you don't know how long you're going to last. And that's one wonderful feature of the defined benefit approaches. On the whole, the actuary for PERS and TRS, they don't know how long each individual is going to live, but they're very accurate on how long the group lives. So they design a pension that just pays out till they die and then it stops. And if some people die earlier, that's less money they need to pay them and more money they have for someone else. So it's a very efficient delivery tool. And then this is one of the reasons that the membership is more in favor of a defined benefit approach than a defined contribution approach. So the trick is, how do we design something that has some of these great features but doesn't leave the state holding the bag if things don't turn out as well as is expected? And that's what I think we're going to talk about in a few minutes. So if we can go to slide 3, please.
A question from Senator Stevens.
Thank you, and thank you for your comments, and I look forward to hearing this. You know, as I'm always concerned the impact on, particularly on our teachers, and one of the problems with the current retirement system is that there is a portability that means that people often stay here for a few years and then leave. Does this change that you are suggesting we look at affect portability at all?
Kind of. It creates more what I would call handcuffs, that they don't want to leave. If you want to build a system that really encourages and facilitates teachers or public safety or anybody leaving the profession and going somewhere else, you've already got the perfect system for that. The one you have has it kind of, not only is it portable, but it front loads the benefit. You know, like in my case, I'm 62. I've been saving. I sold a house back when I was 30, and the appreciation has just been phenomenal in the last 32 years. So in a 401k plan, the amount you save young is more valuable than the amount you save when you're old. So yeah, this wouldn't eliminate portability because you'd still have a meaningful benefit, but it would definitely kind of. Right now, your plan is skewed towards encouraging portability. This would skew it back to the way other public plans around the country are. Does that answer your question, Senator?
It does indeed. Thank you very much.
Okay. I can't tell if we're on page 3 or not.
Slide 3 is that.
Does the first line say bills to return to defined benefit program?
Certainly does.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, I apologize. There's a little bit of glare on the big screen.
That's fine.
So basically, ever since shortly after 2005, there were bills introduced to just flip back. You know, in 2005, the legislature made a fairly quick decision to close the defined benefit structure and add this new defined contribution retirement. And, you know, primarily at the impetus of labor, ever since at least 2011, maybe earlier, Senator Egan and now Senator Keel have been introducing bills, legislation to just kind of revert back. I was involved with those to some extent And I met several of the legislature, the members of the legislature, you know, about 6 or 7 years ago. I don't recall if I've met any of you. Anyway, in the meantime, public safety, they kind of took a different approach. They introduced a bill. You know, I think they realized that politically, maybe this wasn't that viable an option just to completely switch back and, you know, undo what was done in 2005. They had introduced a bill, which is now HB 55, and I've been assisting them on that. Although in that case, I've been assisting the labor organization, not the legislature. The way that plan works and the way this plan is kind of modeled is there's a so currently the employers in public safety pay 22% of compensation on behalf of each of their public safety members. Of that 22, 10 goes to benefits under this the current 401k type plan, and the remainder, which is about 12, pays off the unfunded liability. As you all know, you've got a big legacy unfunded liability for based on people hired before 2005. The public safety bill is wants to change that. So it, first of all, instead of 10, it's going to go up to 12. So there will be a little bit of a cost, but it's going to go into a new program. And then the people hired since 2005 and then anyone hired in the future have a choice of taking their accounts and buying into the new program to the extent they can. And that program has a lot of features to kind of keep the costs manageable. And that's what I'm going to describe shortly for the teachers group. So let's go to slide four, please.
And just a note.
So the way you make.
Just a note to anyone viewing this is that this PowerPoint is available on the Senate Education Committee webpage under today under documents. So we're on slide four now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The kind of the question is, how do we get the current structure to provide a somewhat more secure benefit for the members without leaving the employers completely holding the bag if things aren't as good as expected? So we do that in a couple ways. One is we build in what I'm calling a contribution margin, where the cost of the new program is less. I'm sorry, the cost on an actuarial basis, which is basically just someone's assumption, is less than the amount going in. And what that does is it builds up a cushion. In other words, I think it's going to cost 10% or 12% of pay, but I'm sorry, if I think it's going to cost 11% of pay, but we're putting in 12, for example, that eventually would build up a cushion. So that's one feature is that there's on the public safety bill as well as a potential bill for teachers and other PERS, the idea is to build in a cushion. The other, and to do that, you have a new tier that's not as valuable as the old tier. So, for example, for police and fire, there's, as you may know, for those of you that retire from public service in Alaska, if you stay in Alaska as a retiree, you get an extra 10%. If you move down to the lower 48, you don't get that extra 10%. And so one easy change is take that away. If we take that away, you know, only about half of the people stay in Alaska, so that would say maybe 5% of the cost. We put in a minimum retirement age for the public safety. We changed the public safety final year salary averaging period. When a teacher retires right now from tier two, you know, the one that was hired just before 2005, that teacher, their benefit is based on their average pay over 5 years. What police and fire used to have is over 3 years. And what that does is it allows them to work a lot of overtime or, you know, wait for a promotion and then just retire then. And it costs extra to have benefit calculated over 3 years versus five. So for police and fire, we changed that down to five. But the most important thing, I think, is that third bullet, triggers in case the plan becomes underfunded. So the idea is that if things in a certain year aren't if they're worse than expected, they would suspend the post-retirement pension adjustment. You have basically a cost of living adjustment, like a CPI-based adjustment. That would be suspended if the plan's underfunded. And then also in that bill, would, again, this is patterned after, the member contributions would ratchet up. The members would have to pay an extra 1% of pay if the plan's underfunded. And you could even have the employers pay an extra 1% of pay. So the idea to make this plan more stable and less risky on the employers is to put in these triggers to change things. And then another feature is the health benefit, the health retirement account would stay the same. You have fairly expensive health benefits for your people hired before 2005. Part of what your 2005 legislation did was, you know, kind of ratcheted that down a little bit. Mr. Chair, can we go to slide five, please?
We have a question Senator Begich, and also I'd like to welcome Senator Machicki to the meeting, but a question from Senator Begich.
My question's just a comment in good humor. We are the Education Committee. You spelled health wrong, so we just pointed out.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate that.
And also a question from Senator Stevens, not grammar related, I believe.
No, just a quick question. You talk about increasing member contribution up by, on paper it says 2%, and you said 1% for those two.
Thank you, Senator. I should have clarified. The idea is that we do it 1% at a time. So in other words, the first time you're under 90%, you're under a 90% funded threshold, we ratchet up contributions by 1%. Maybe a year or two later, it'd be another 1%, but we cap it at 2%. And the ARM board, the way that legislation's crafted is the ARM board has complete authority to decide what to do. You know, it could say, hey, we're only at 89.9, let's wait another year. It could say, let's go up by 2 this year. I modeled it assuming you went up by 1 at a time, at most twice.
All right, we're on slide five.
Okay, so that's kind of a background of where we were, where the public safety is. And I know your education and not public safety, but I thought it was helpful to be grounded in what this is patterned after. So I'm on slide five. So in 2020, last year, the Alaska Public Pension Coalition, so it's a coalition of unions, NEA, or the Alaska equivalent of NEA, AFSCME, and maybe a couple others, with whom I've been doing a little bit of work in the past, asked me, okay, why don't you do what you did for fire, police and fire for us? And so I kind of did a bunch of analysis, and Senator Begich is going to comment on my other grammar area. A proposed plan was presented, not a proposed plan. So I kind of crafted out what might work. Now, they've never really analyzed this. So this is not a union proposal. This is some think actuary's idea of what might work. My last goal is important. If you want to take this approach, I recommend that somebody, you know, really sits down with pencil and paper with me or someone else and says, okay, what might we do? And then late last year, Representative Tuck had me do, you know, for the legislature, had me do this study that you're seeing now. So, and that's what I'm about to analyze. So let's go to slide six, please, unless, Mr. Chairman, there are other questions?
No questions.
Okay, so slide six says TERS and other PERS could have a similar structure. So the idea is that the proposed plan would have employer costs, in other words, what the employer is putting in, at exactly the same level. So the idea is we don't want it to cost any more for the employers. That's a little bit different than public safety. I think public safety thought they had a little more bargaining power and are proposing a plan that costs a little bit more. What the plan I crafted out would cost the same. So the idea is we'll take the money that's being put in on behalf for their DC accounts, 401k type accounts, but instead we'll put it into a new plan, still managed by, you know, the same retirement system and the ARM board and so on. But we design it to have lower benefits than what we had back before 2005, because we realized that those might be too high or too costly. And then this cost difference would build up a cushion to allow a well-funded plan to evolve. And if experience was worse than expected, unfavorable, there would either be the 1 or 2% contribution increases or some kind of reduction in benefit. Now, so on an actuarial basis, this plan isn't quite as valuable to a teacher as the current plan, but the teacher has two advantages, and, you know, and first of all, it's going to be voluntary whether they want to transfer their money over. But the big advantage is, in my opinion, is they don't know how long they're going to live. So this gives them a lifetime income structure. And the second advantage is the ARM board is probably better investors than the average teacher. The average teacher knows how to spell health, and the average teacher knows a lot of other things, but they probably aren't as good as investing as the professionals at the ARM board. So in the long run, the returns are going to be better if ARM board is investing it on the long term rather than having an individual teacher try to invest it on their short term. So I'm going to go to slide.
Quick question.
I guess it's seven.
Question from Senator Beckett.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Holland. Just to be clear, and so the option, if we adopted this, we would have an option where an employee could stay within the current program they're in, or they could shift to this. And would a new employee automatically be here, or would they have the option of, would they have an option between a DC or a DB plan under this? Would they just go into this?
Yeah, through the chair, you could design it either way, and my analysis doesn't matter. I would recommend you give them a choice. It makes a lot of sense. Some teachers might just be in Alaska for the first 5 years of their career, and or maybe they don't know about if they want to go into teaching. So it seems reasonable. Some systems that have this structure do have a choice, but it makes more sense, in my opinion, to give the, you know, post-2022 or whatever teachers a choice.
Thank you.
But my analysis is independent of that. None of the numbers make a difference in that case. Okay, if we can go to slide seven, please. And I'm going to come back to this. So this is a line chart, correct? I'm going to come back to this chart in a little bit. But the idea here is, in the real world, returns are very volatile, investment returns. And we did 10,000 potential simulations of what future investment returns might look like. And we used assumptions that were basically the same ones the ARM board uses, their outside advisors use. They've got an actuary and they've got investment consultants. And based on those, we did these 10,000 simulations and we just picked two of them that were kind of on the average. And as you can see, even if you're on the average, things are going to be volatile. So this plan, for example, the orange line, which turns out to be the better case, was, you know, became underfunded within about 6 years. But then the 90% triggers were impacted, and it gradually got back to 90 and then over 100. And by the end of year 25 or so, it was like 120% funded. So that was one scenario. And then another scenario that was kind of an average scenario was the opposite, where things were absolutely booming for the first 7 years. It got to 140% funded, or 100, I can't read my chart, but, you know, very well funded. And then dropped back down, then bounced up, dropped down, and then in the last 5 or 10 years had gone below 90. So what is the challenge here is that, you know, so in the real world, all these pension funds in the 90s were just booming, and they were like looking like that blue line at the beginning. And then the tech bubble burst, and then we had the Great Recession, and then interest rates came down, and actuaries changed their assumptions. And so, you know, in the case that actually did happen, which was primarily in the 80s and 90s when pension funds were building up, they were doing great, and then they came back down. In the next 25 years, we don't know what's going to happen. It might look like the blue line. It might look like the orange line. It might look totally different. But my point is that one of the problems with this defined benefit structure is you might think things are really good and they turn bad. You might think that things are bad and they turn really good. So the hopeful news is maybe your legacy tiers are towards the bottom of that orange line at the beginning and things are going to be picking right back up. We don't know. Let me go on to slide eight, please, and tell you how we did these simulations. So because we had these simulations to protect against the downside risk, these safeguards rather, and again, the safeguards are you start out with lower benefits than the contributions should be able to pay for, and if you fall below in the comfort level of, in this case, 90%, you do things to either reduce benefits or increase contributions. Under those scenarios, there's a high likelihood of being extremely well-funded, although there's still some risk of being underfunded, and I'll show those in a few minutes. So if we could, let's go to slide 9. So the question is, how do you avoid having additional unexpected costs in a potential new program? And we do it in one way on this slide, is that we start out with a program that costs less than we think the contribution is going to be. So this excess of what I'm calling ER cost, the employer cost, the excess of that over what's called the normal cost, which is the actuarially estimated ongoing cost, if you have a cushion there, then it should build up a surplus and minimize the need for something bad happening. But as we saw two slides above, things are volatile, so it could work either way. If we can, let's go to slide 10. I've got a bunch of numbers here, and I don't think it's worthwhile spending too much time on this. But the idea was the following. If you look at the right-hand column that's TRS, the teachers, I think that's what you're most interested in. So for those people in Tier 2, the ones that were hired right before 2005, the actuary, you know, this is their actuary, the the retirement systems actuary, has estimated the cost of that plan is 14.63% of pay. So if the actuary's estimates are right, on the average, that will pay for the plan. Of that, the members are putting in 8.65%, which leaves the employer responsible for 5.98%. Now, that's for the people hired before 2005. For the ones hired after 2005, it's a little bit different. I'm ignoring health. This is just the pension features. The health plan makes sense to leave it the way it is. There's a fairly small cost for death and disability benefits. I mean, there are some teachers that die before retirement age and some teachers that become disabled, but they don't cost very much. They cost 0.08% of pay. That's already exists and being funded somewhere. The employers are putting 7% of pay into their 401k style account, and then they themselves are putting in 8% of pay. So in the teacher's case, there's 15.08% going in under the current structure. And if we were to simply flip it back to the old structure and the actuarial costs were right, there would be a cushion of, 15% going in, 15.08, 14.63 is the cost of it. So that means you're putting in 3% more than the cost was for the old tier. But that's only if things are exactly the way the actuary thinks they're going to be. So the teachers, the nice thing is there's a 3% cushion built up already. On slide 11, let's skip 11 because that's PERS. Slide 12, which is the same slide for teachers, I've designed what would be a potential tier 4. Same numbers at the first part is that, so the current plan costs the tier 2 costs 14.6. The tier 3 contribution is 15.08, so there's a little extra going in already. If we were to make one change to this program of just simply removing the Alaska COLA, this 10% I mentioned earlier on, that would save about 6.7% of pay, which would get their costs down to 13.96. So the way this is crafted here is that we just make one simple change. We take away the Alaska COLA. All of a sudden, it costs a little bit less than the contribution going in. So this 8% cushion is designed to help build up a cushion or a surplus. And again, if everything turns out the way the actuary believes it's going to turn out, there will be an 8% surplus. This plan will eventually be 108% funded. If we can go forward two slides. And Mr. Chairman, how would you like to do time? I don't want to take too much of your time. I could talk for another 10 minutes. I could talk for another 15 minutes. I could take questions.
We're scheduled to go to at least 10:30 today, and if you had a little bit beyond that, we could probably handle that. We have a floor session coming up. Some people have to leave probably at least by quarter till or so. But I'd suggest at least strongly going to 10:30 and taking questions as we roll through this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll do that. And we're about halfway through, so a little over halfway through. Okay, so slide 14. For teachers, all I've modeled is we keep the same benefits as Tier 2 with one exception, and that exception's in red. The benefits for Tier 2 is that teachers can either work till age 60 to retire, or they can work 30 years, or if they want to retire early at age 55, there's what's called an actuarial reduction, where it's like the way Social Security works. You know how if you retire at 62, you get less than if you wait till 65, you get even less than if you wait till 70? That's the idea, is that there's an adjustment factor based on how long you're projected to live. And if you retire earlier, you're going to get more benefits, so they give you a lower pension. That's the way TRS Tier 2 works now. They use a five-year average monthly compensation. They've got a multiplier, in other words. So if you work 20 years, you get 2% times 20, you get a 40% of pay pension benefit. If you work 30 years, you get that 40 plus another 25, you get 65% of pay. So we keep that same adjustment, or same formula. We allow for post-retirement pension adjustments. That's a CPI-type benefit increase. But we would take away that Alaska COLA. And again, what this did is that created an 8% cushion. So from there, let's go to slide 15, please, unless there's a question. From there, we did these simulations that ended up with that line chart I showed you a few minutes ago. So all these calculations are based on actuaries' estimate, with input from investment consultants and so on, of what the future returns are going to be. But we all know those returns are not going to be right. They'll either be higher or lower. Hopefully they're more higher than lower, but they're going to be volatile. So even though the anticipated cost is 8% less than the contribution going in, there's a decent chance that the plan will become underfunded. Like, on the average, we think we're going to earn, say, 7 or 8% in the stock markets. Well, we almost never earn 7 or 8. We earn 6, or we earn 9, or we earn 0, or we earn 22. The markets are not smooth. If they were smooth, the returns would be a lot lower. So even though the cost is less than the contribution going in, there's still a decent chance it becomes underfunded. So to protect against this, we put in these safeguards beyond that cushion. One safeguard is if it becomes poorly funded, you skip the pension CPI adjustment. The other safeguards are the contributions goes up. So if we can go to slide 16, please.
Just have a quick question.
A quick question from Senator Begich.
And I do want to just be sure your modeling shows that then when you get through the crisis, does the adjustment go away? The safeguards then retreat, as it were, or do you keep them in place?
Same answer. That's up to the legislation, but the way I modeled it is it goes away.
Okay, thank you.
We don't go back and repay CPI adjustments that didn't go, but we put the contributions back down.
I understand it. So.
I think, and that makes sense. But again, you can draft the legislation any way you want. But and that's up to the ARM board. I believe in the public safety legislation, that's up to the ARM board on how to make it go away. I would recommend that you let it go away.
Thank you.
And curiously, Colorado, my state, recently, they never did what you did in 2005, but they had some changes in 2018 that have, they call them, auto adjust. So every year they make an announcement whether you're going to get your COLA or not and whether the contributions have to go up or not. And so based on last year's returns and the actuarial status, and they're also poorly funded like you are for their legacy plan. But their idea is that when things get better, they'll take that away. And if you don't mind, let me digress a little bit, but a lot of states are doing this. So instead of making the major change you all made in 2005, they've been making more minor changes to get down to something closer to this model. Lots of states have something that's variable. Wisconsin has a variable, COLA, South Dakota has variable, Texas Municipal has variable benefits. I mean, the idea is that, you know, you've all were burned. You know, you guys were burned by returns not being as high as expected, as well as other things. Other states have had the same problem. You know, and frankly, the reduction in the interest rates, right? We can get a more, you know, when I started this business, my mortgage was like 12%. Now I can get a mortgage for less than 2%. And it's the same thing with a pension fund. The pension fund used to be pretty sure they could earn 12%. They could have just loaned it out in mortgages. But now they can't. So, you know, these funds that looked really good in the 90s didn't look so good 10 years later. And 10 years later, now they still don't look so good. Anyway, so let's go to slide 16. So to illustrate this model, we did what we call stochastic modeling. I hope we can kind of imagine what that is. But basically, based on what the investment consultants and the actuaries for the retirement or the ARM board, based on what they think is like the neutral, the best estimate, they think the fund will earn 7.38% on the average year after year. They also think, this is where the investment consultants come in, that the volatility which is called the standard deviation, or similar to the standard deviation, is 13%. What that means is about a sixth of the time that you'll get returns better than 21%, about a sixth of the time you get returns less than minus 7, and then the other a third of the time will be between minus 7 and 7 and plus 7. The other third will be between plus 7 and plus 21. So they've got what's called a distribution, a statistical distribution of potential returns. We feed that into a little projection program, bank knockout, 10,000 simulations of what might happen, and then see how would the auto adjust, how would the triggers work, how would the COLA go away, and what would be, you know, how many new people are coming in. And we just model all this potential future activity 10,000 different times, and then kind of slice it and dice it to see what happens. So if we can go to slide 17, what we did is in these 10,000 cases, whenever the funded ratio slipped below 90%, we activated the triggers. We not ratchet up the contribution by 1%. We'd suspend the post-retirement pension adjustment. So then slide 18, it starts to show some of our results, and then I've got it pictorially too. On slide 18, basically we found a pretty high likelihood, 59% likelihood, that teachers would be better than 100% funded in most years. Okay, so of the 10,000, more than 5,000 of them, most of the time, those were above 100% funded, which makes sense because we started out with a cushion. The median in 20 years, so of the 10,000 cases, if you took case number 5,000, the one right in the middle, that was 108% funded, which also makes sense because we built in an 8% cushion. But there's still a decent chance, about a 29% chance, that after 20 years, that the triggers would be in place. In other words, case number 2,900 out of 10,000 was at a 90% funded ratio. And then the bottom bullet, you know, there's still even a 14% chance that they'd be below a 75% funded ratio. So, you know, even with these kinds of things, there's still some risk that the plan would be underfunded. But there's a greater chance, as slide 19 shows, that the plan is overfunded.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Baggett.
And just to be clear, that under the current scenario, we also run the same, basically there are same sequences of risks.
Through the chair, yeah, but it's even worse because you've got nothing to help you on the downside.
Just to clarify.
Under the current structure, the pre-2005 structure, there's risk that you guys are all paying the price for right now. And that risk can continue, but there's no downside protection. For the people hired since 2005, That risk is all on them. In other words, when they retire, they've got charts that look, you know, if they were to hire, if they were to, you know, have a financial analyst look at the possible outcomes, they would have a lot of risk too. The way they're managing that risk is probably by just going into secure investments, which means they have lower returns. So they're probably, you know, depending on how much money you have when you retire, you should probably be more in fixed income safe investments than risky investments. Senator Begich, I'm not sure if I completely answered your question. Was that?
You did. What I was getting at was where we are. If we make this change, are we in a better position as a state than we would be if we just stayed as we were? And in terms of our risk end, I'm not talking about in terms of our ability to recruit teachers, et cetera, just on the simple risk question, it sounds like there would still be a risk if we stayed as we are, because we're constantly talking about topping off our benefits.
Yeah, if through the chair, if you don't make any changes and you just don't have any, you wiped out future risk back in 2005. You basically said, we're tired of this. Anyone we hire after 2005, you're on your own. We'll give you 8% of pay. We'll give you some place to invest it. Well, that's it. You know, we'll give you some advice on how to invest it, but that's it. So you have no risk other than secondary risk for the people you've hired after 2005. You've got the risk of not enough police and firefighters, not enough teachers. You do have the risk of them coming back, you know, at age 80 and saying, look, I'm out of money. Can I go on state assistance of some kind? But that's really not much risk compared to the risk that they're taking. And the risk that we've analyzed here is a new risk. So there's no question. You're taking less risk than the old tiers, but you're taking more risk than the current tier. And you're getting rid of a lot more risk for the employees.
Which is the inducement. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you. So with that statement at the top of the page, it's as likely, so 50-50 split on risk between 131% and 90%, below 90%, which means you're leaning much heavier above, that must be the 59 versus the lower.
Senator, that's basically correct. So, the idea is this is not balanced. You've got protection on the downside, and you just let it run on the upside.
So where my question's going is, with the boosted contributions between 1 and 4% split 50-50 between employees and employer, does that get you at 100% above 90%? If you think about that 4% potential top side of additional boosted contributions, is there any risk that you'd be below 90% when you include those boosted contributions?
Senator, through the chair, yes, there is. That's kind of a problem, is that there's no guarantees of cutting out the downside risk. Well, I guess you could be more harsh with cutting back pension benefits, I suppose. You could design something. But so what we're trying to show here is that even though there's 14%, or no, I said there was a 29% chance that you'd be below 90%. But there's also a 29% chance that you'd be above 131%. So, you know, that sounds like a pretty good deal. In other words, but there's still some chance, you're 29% of being below 90 and 14% chance of being below 75. You know, that you have to continue those extra 2% contributions to try to get out of it. And it still might not be enough. We just don't know what future markets are going to do. I would argue that if we are in those bad situations, they'd be, and we don't make a change, we'd have much more calamitous results in terms of our retired teachers. You know, if 20 years from now, if the markets have only returned 5% on the average, let's say, instead of 7, you know, retired teachers are going to be have a very difficult time living on the 15% contributions that have been going in through their whole career. So we're shifting something where right now all the risk is on the retired teachers and the active teachers. And under the legacy program, all the risk is on the state. Well, of all the risks the active teachers are taking, two of them we can pretty much get rid of at no cost. The life expectancy risk, and then the need to become more conservative as you get older. You know, but the rest of the risk has to go somewhere. And in this case, a lot of it's going on the teachers by paying an extra 2% and by not getting their post-retirement pension adjustment. But a lot of it's staying with the employers too. And, you know, there is, what did I say, a 14% likelihood that 20 years from now, we'll be looking back and saying, wow, we've had a pretty bad 20 years, and our pension is now at 75% funded. So that is a realistic possibility.
Thank you.
And one other quick question, Ms. Fournier. So this new plan also has some cushion built in to help compensate for the risk for the pre-2005 members as well. Did you mention that?
Well, there's no new cushion, Mr. Chair. There's right now, and I don't remember the number, but the employers are paying. Remember I said there's 8% the employer contribution. The employers are paying on behalf of their teachers a certain amount that goes into the teachers' accounts, a certain amount that goes to the healthcare accounts, and then another amount that goes into pay off the legacy liability for older teachers. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are not going to change. The change is going to be the amount that instead of going into the teachers' 401k type accounts, it'll go into this account. So that the cushion is all staying with this new account. That's the idea. Now, on the other hand, if you look at these bars if we're still on page 19, there's a lot of cases where there's a lot of big numbers above the line. I mean, maybe, and some of them probably don't have that great of returns. Maybe they're 8% instead of, or even the seven, even the median that has an 8% cushion. I mean, maybe you could do something where, 20 years from now, you merge the plans, the legacy plans, and you merge the new plan, and you just keep some accounting straight so that the triggers don't hurt the people. Because, under the good scenario, you'll probably be pretty close to paid off on the legacy plans.
Well, Mr. Fournier, I'd encourage you to move on ahead because we're going to start losing our senators as we get closer to 10:40.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's go to slide 21. I think we've covered most of what I wanted to make sure to cover, but slide 21 shows, and that should be like a line chart.
Looks like the same.
Yeah, that looks like with a blue line and an orange line. We showed them before. Basically, I just want to show you again. So out of these 10,000, we picked number 5,008 and number 4,996 and just showed that even some of these middle-of-the-road cases is still going to have some volatility. But if you don't mind, indulge me. Imagine you're a retiree and you've seen this kind of volatility in your return. So you retire at the left-hand side, and if you're on the blue line of future, all of a sudden 7 years in, you think you're sitting in Fat City, but then by year 10, you're back even, and then later on, you get even, when you're getting older, your returns are terrible. So, the same simulations that could happen to the pension fund would also be happening to individuals that are retired. The rest of these are pretty technical, and I think you've gotten the idea. Well, let's go up to slide 25, if you don't mind. It sounds from your questions that you have a pretty good understanding of what A is in HB 55, which you might be voting on, as well as B, what might work for teachers. So slide 25 is just some text, and I guess, this is the point I just made. When we look at bad scenarios that are bad for the pension fund, if you don't change, they're bad for the teachers, and they're even worse for the teachers because the teachers don't have the tools to get the stronger returns, and they don't know how long they're going to live. So, you know, even though there is a 14% chance in this case of being 75% funded or worse, you know, 75, first of all, it's not that bad. That's about what this national average is right now. Although, you know, arguably there's a pension crisis around the country that, you know, public pension funds around the country are not as well enough, as well funded as they should be, meaning future taxpayers have to pay for that. Second bullet on 285 is that, you know, if the actuary needs to change the assumed rate of return again, that would also reduce our funded ratios. So your actuaries, like most actuaries around the country, have realized that they were too optimistic in the assumed rates of return in the past. That plus, you know, Federal Reserve actions and all this, everything has caused interest rates to go down, have caused the actuaries to reduce their expected returns. And then if we can just go to slide 26, that's pretty much the conclusion. Actually, let's do 27. It's a little better.
A question from Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I have a question. Just on slide 25, the kind of further decrease line, has anyone put enough thought into a defined contribution plan or defined benefit plan where you actually split out what happens if there is additional risk, like in advance, saying if this happens, the employer's willing to go up this amount in higher contributions with a match of these reductions in benefits. Has anyone put that kind of thought into a plan where you know what that is going to look like if an imbalance occurs?
Well, Senator, I think that's exactly what we're doing here. We're only doing it in two ways. We're taking away the cost of living, the CPI adjustment. So in advance, the employees know that if we fall below 90% funded, which is, you know, a kind of a yellow light, warning light, you will not get your cost of living, the CPI adjustment, and your contributions will go up by 1%. So that's the whole idea. In advance, you do this. That's why those other bar charts were not symmetrical. You know, there's a lot more upside than downside, because whenever things got bad, we pushed it back up. I think there's that idea is basically what other states are starting to try to do in what's being proposed here. In advance, you tell the members, look, we want to give you a defined benefit plan, but we don't know if it's going to work. And if it's not going to work well enough, we want you to share in the pain. And, you know, Missouri does that. So Missouri teachers, when their contribution rate goes up, the members' contribution rate also goes up. You know, split 50-50. Nevada teachers are the same way. There's just lots of little ways, and this proposal, so to speak, has a few of them, where what you want to do is have the nice structure of a defined benefit plan, but don't make the employers take all the risk. In advance, let the members know, if things don't turn out so well, this might happen, this might happen, this might happen. And the two this's we've got in here are your contributions might go up and your cost, your CPI adjustment might not be born.
Just a brief follow-up on that. I guess I'm thinking more about the 14% chance, right? When you run out of benefit reduction options and it's a pretty hard hit to the state. How do you split once you get that? If you get into that situation, no matter how unlikely a 14% below 75% is at year 20, how could you adjust to that limit? I mean, is that at some point it falls just on the taxpayer? There's not enough benefits left to reduce.
Well, in this case, through the chair, in this case, we haven't designed any potential future adjustments. You certainly could. That would be very reasonable to have, you could have several other little adjustments in there. I mean, the problem you're facing now is a lot of your costs are on your retirees, right? Because, you know, most of your workers have been hired since 2005. What Wisconsin did is they've got something, and this worked very well with the Great Recession. They had a cost of living type, a variable benefit feature for the retirees. Their benefits actually went down for a few years. in 2009, 2010. You could do something like that. And I encourage you to explore some of these things, because that's exactly what can help protect you from protect this taxpayers from the downside, yet still give the members some security, and hopefully we won't have a downside.
Thank you. Thank you. I think you want to go to slide 27.
Yeah, that's just a conclusion. So basically, we put in these safeguards similar to what Senator Machichi was discussing, where at some point they get triggers. You know, you could, and as a result of that, there's a high likelihood of being extremely well funded, but there's still some risk of being underfunded. You know, if you want to go down this path, I encourage you to consider other things that mitigate these other risks too.
Ask a final question.
I have a question from Senator Machichi, and then a few more questions from other members.
So your likelihood of being above 100 is much higher than your likelihood of being below 90%. That seems like a marketable hedge.
Yeah.
Are there packages where people will buy that risk that eliminates the risk on the state? It seems like a fair bet. I'm using the words like hedge and bet for a reason, but is that risk marketable?
Yeah, I think it just costs too much. I mean, otherwise the Armboard would have been doing it. You know, they would, you know, it's like buying a 30-year put on the S&P or something like that. I think the problem is it's so far out and pretty expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that. Yeah, no, the problem is the short term, the volatility is just too great. I haven't seen anything like that. I mean, in the short run, it would just be like, yeah, investing most of your money in the S&P and then having part of it on a either a covered call option or a put option to get. No, it's a great idea, but I think it's just still too much risk, and I don't think the financial institutions have that long of a time horizon either to be able to handle it.
And a question from
a
question from Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you so much. I really have enjoyed this conversation, and it's great to hear that there are other options out there. We know we have a problem. I like the idea of a choice being available. But I would like to return to the COLA issue. Alaska may be different than other states. When I first got here in 1970, everyone who retired left, and no one stayed in Alaska much who had retired. And so I assume the legislature at one point said, yeah, we want a variety of ages in our communities, and I assume that's why we have that. The legislature put that in. I guess I just would like to know what we're losing in not having COLA. Certainly it's an option. People don't have to choose that, but by eliminating COLA, I think we might go back to the days where we only had young people living here and no elderly. So I wonder if there's some way to do a more balanced citizenry, and as a grandparent, I don't want to leave my grandchildren here without me. You know? But anyway, is there something like a variable within COLA so that it goes COLA goes down when things get bad, COLA goes back up when things get better?
Senator, through the chair, that's an excellent question. And the whole idea is, I picked the low hanging fruit, the things that were easy to calculate, frankly. I mean, maybe you could reduce the retirement age instead of taking away the COLA. I know HB 55 for the police and fire, and this is the police and fire themselves, they thought, okay, this is something we can live without. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know the history of that, but I'll bet you that COLA was put in when things were booming and you thought you had an overfunded pension plan, maybe in the early 90s. I'm just guessing. But that would make tons of sense, because in the 90s, everybody thought this is a great approach. Things will never be bad. And that would be an easy little adjustment for the legislature to have passed sometime back then. I don't know what your history is. I also don't know if there's any studies that show retention of older, you know, citizens that are in public service with Alaska COLA versus the others. I don't know the answer to that. But by all means, I don't care what benefit cuts you do. I just think you want to build in a plan that costs a little bit less than the contributions going in.
Absolutely. I agree with you totally. And it'd be interesting to look at that reducing the retirement age. I think that would be an appropriate thing to look
increasing.
At as well. Yeah, and increasing the retirement age.
Well, thank you for your time, Mr. Forney. I think we've exhausted the questions. Do you have any final comments?
No, I wish I were in Juneau. That's it. I'm taking my first plane ride to meet with the Ohio legislature on Wednesday, and I wish I was going to Alaska instead.
Well, thank you for your time this morning. This is helpful information as we consider the recommendations from the Teacher Recruitment and Retention Working Group. Our next meeting is Wednesday, May 12th at 9 a.m. Is there any other business for the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned at 10:43.